Welcome to Oncology Today, Management of Desmoid Tumors. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this program, I met with Dr. Renald Gounder from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York City. In addition to this interview program, there's also a corresponding video featuring Dr. Gounder's slide presentation. To begin, I asked him to provide an overview of the incidence and prevalence of desmoid tumors.
So sarcomas, you know, just to put things in context for the listeners, is 1% of all malignancies. So with an annual incidence of just around 15,000 patients in the United States. And relevant to our discussion today, desmoid tumors are probably about 10% of that number. And depending on which source you look at, is the incidence is somewhere around 1,000 patients in the United States annually. The prevalence is much higher because the mortality from this disease is close to zero, but not zero. So the prevalence is a little higher, but the annual incidence is about 1,000 new patients in the U.S. And these tumors are basically tumors of the connective tissue, and the cell of origin are fibroblasts. Some people think they are myofibroblasts. And these tumors can pretty much arise anywhere from head to toe and in anyone. I've seen kids who are 3 months old get a desmoid tumor that's aggressive and moving fast, to someone who is 89 years old. So it's across the whole wide spectrum, and it can really arise anywhere from head to toe, but all sort of in the connective tissue musculature of the body.
You mentioned the prevalence. It's surprisingly hard to find a number for that. I would think it would be very high, like maybe 50,000 or something. What's your number sort of in the U.S.?
Yeah, I think this is a commonly asked question, but it's very hard to get to it because, you know, these things don't have a specific code. So they all get sort of coded under sarcomas. So it's hard to get to, but I don't think the prevalence is that high because I think the vast majority of patients do end up getting some form of treatment, whether it's surgery or chemotherapy, what have you. And so in a matter of 5 years or 6 or 7 years, most of those people end up getting fully treated. My own sense is that the prevalence is not that high, but we truly don't have a good sense of that number.
But I mean, when you say fully treated, you mean cured?
Cured, controlled, you know, resected. But they may have undergone multiple lines of drugs, you know, other therapies like localized therapies like ablation or surgery, different modalities that can ultimately control, cure the disease, correct?
Can you comment on what we know about the biology of the disease and also why it is that it doesn't seem to metastasize?
Yeah, I can answer the second question first because I can tell you that we don't know why it does not metastasize. There is a host of these sarcomas which are in the intermediate grade range. So these have, they don't metastasize. Sometimes you can have multifocal desmoids, which means that if you have a desmoid in the leg, you can have another one, you know, in the hip. But, you know, more commonly, they don't have a potentiality to metastasize. In terms of the biology, it's really fascinating because these tumors are almost entirely due to activation of the Wnt beta-catenin or the Wnt signaling pathway. The Wnt and Notch signaling pathways have been implicated. And when we see that the vast majority of patients have mutations in beta-catenin, which then leads to upregulation of the Wnt signaling pathway. And those who don't have beta-catenin, they have mutations in APC gene, which is associated with the familial adenomatous polyposis syndrome. So pretty much between beta-catenin and FAP, they both lead to sort of a strong upregulation of the Wnt signaling pathway.
And I see that it's more common in women, and there seems to be some connection to the endocrine pathway. I think even endocrine therapy has been used. Kind of, what's the deal there?
We're not 100% sure. I think people have looked at the link between female gender and whether that is somehow driven by, you know, estrogen or some other hormones, but I think a lot that association is a weak association. Sometimes we see it with pregnancy, and the tendency is to, you know, attribute to some of the hormones that change with pregnancy. But increasingly, we don't think this is sort of an estrogen, progesterone, one of those reproductive hormone related things, but rather maybe related to changes in the vascular biology that happens with pregnancy, maybe related to changes in VEGF and platelet-derived growth factors, other things related to fluid shifts and changes in vascular endothelial growth factors is a way we are thinking forward for multiple reasons. One, although hormonal blockade has been used in the past, increasingly the data showing that their efficacy is really low. And in many of the newer consensus guidelines, we are moving away from tamoxifen, which has historically been used for a really, really long time.
So, you know, keeping the idea of the biology, you mentioned VEGF. We're going to talk a little bit about the fact that TKIs, VEGF TKIs have been used and seem to have some responsiveness in this. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Are these very vascular neoplasms, you know, under the microscope? What do we know about the connection of VEGF?
Yeah. So I think the connection with VEGF is very early, and we're really not sure. It may be VEGF, it may be PDGF. The biology is significantly lagging behind the treatment paradigms itself. So I think we are finding that drugs are working, but we are now trying to figure out why these drugs are working and what is the mechanism. If you look at these tumors under the microscope, if you did not alert someone, a pathologist, to it, they may look like a bland tumor, probably something very similar to a healing wound. Very often, if you gave it to a pathologist and said, what does this look like? It may look like a robust wound healing process. So, you know, increasingly, we're also thinking that there may be mechanisms of underlying wound healing that may be spurring these tumors. Because there is, you know, in some quarters, people think maybe this was initiated by a trauma. It could be surgical trauma. It could be blunt trauma. But, you know, the jury's out there in terms of that association.
So what's the typical location, a clinical presentation? I'm guessing that these people feel something or see something. They go to a primary care doc. They send them a surgeon. They get biopsied. Like, where do you see these tumors, and how does the location affect the way you look at these patients when you first see them clinically?
No, that's a very, very good question. So, yeah, I mean, the age of presentation, as I mentioned before, can be as young as infants to patients in their 80s and 90s. The location, as I mentioned before, they can really happen anywhere in the body. But the most common sites are extremities. So this could be in the legs as well as in the shoulder and the hand regions. And the second common region is also in the abdomen or in the intraperitoneal area. So if it is in the extremities, you know, you can imagine this will present as a lump, as a mass, as generally as a painless mass, which then leads to investigation. And usually those tumors are, you know, found a little bit more earlier. But deep in the abdomen, in the retroperitoneum or the mesentery, these tumors can get much bigger before they are detected. And in other areas, such as the head and neck, even the smallest tumor can get quickly picked up because, as you know, there's not much real estate in that location.
Getting back to the issue about the biopsy, do you see misdiagnosis?
To some extent, but not a great deal. Sometimes these tumors can be called, you know, like a benign wound healing process or a proliferative process. But, you know, generally with a large mass in the background, for example, a CT or MRI shows a 5-centimeter mass, you know, you know you're looking for something. And I think sooner than later, you find the diagnosis of a desmoid tumor.
So I want to ask you in a second about local therapy, surgery, and other means of local therapy, cryotherapy, radiation therapy. But I'm just also curious in terms of spontaneous regressions. I was, you know, kind of joking. I've never seen a waterfall plot of a placebo that looked as good as you see in this situation, where you actually can see tumors regressing spontaneously. Any thoughts about why, how that occurs, or what's going on when you see a spontaneous regression?
Yeah, so this is really, it's a very interesting phenomenon. And as you can imagine, it makes clinical trial designs very complicated when some patients are just regressing without any therapy. So we don't, the short answer is, again, we don't know why these tumors spontaneously regress. There's many theories. Some think it may be some immunological phenomenon or some other cytokine phenomenon that ebbs and flows in a person that causes these spontaneous remissions. But I would say even in the last 10 years, the field itself, or the people in the field, have really better understood these spontaneous remissions. While, you know, 10 years ago, we thought these were maybe less than 5% or 2 or 3%, and we thought these were truly anecdotal. But now, as more and more prospectively we've been studying these tumors and the more we've understood the biology, we think that the spontaneous remissions can be as high as 20 or 25%, depending on whom you select.
So, of course, that gets into the issue of how you decide whether to start therapy. It seems like it would be a very individualized response, patients, age, and where it is, but also the symptoms. And what kind of symptoms do you see with this? One of the things I love the most about the DeFi study was the patient-reported outcome. So it's really incredible how, and like pain, for example. So are these often painful?
It depends on the location. It depends on the location. It's more painful if it's in the extremities, and it also limits your range of motion and function. It can also be painful if it's in the brachial plexus, if it's in the head and neck region. Those are more painful. In the abdominal wall, or even deep in the abdomen, it's not so much pain, but it could be other issues, maybe some signs of, you know, bloating or even early signs of small bowel obstructions and things of that nature. And but then there is a good number of patients who don't have any symptoms either. So, and then it's really a matter of really pressing and asking the patient. You know, many times patients sort of get used to their symptoms and they kind of forget what baseline used to be like. But unless you push and prod and you really try to get a sense of what is it that they are self-limiting themselves to, you don't really get a full sense of, you know, the impact of this disease on their quality of life.
So I thought it was complicated to figure out when you start treating chronic lymphocytic leukemia, but you don't see spontaneous regressions there. So how do you determine whether you start therapy? And first of all, what's the impact of local treatment, surgery, radiation, cryotherapy? Are there situations where it's helpful, or is it potentially have a poor adverse outcome?
Yeah, I could answer that first, because I think it's important to put it out there that radiation is something that we should not be doing for this disease at all. The risk is, you know, of possible a secondary malignancy that is radiation associated, and we've certainly seen that. And that's certainly not worth the risk, especially in many of these young patients, you know, who have a long life to live. So we do everything possible to not to do radiation at all for these tumors. Surgery, as I mentioned, is challenging for multiple reasons, because even with an R0 resection, you can have tumor recurrence. And with an R1 or R2 resection, you could have complete stability of the disease. So it's very hard to predict, you know, what is the role of surgery. So increasingly surgery is going in the, you know, is getting deprioritized for the vast majority of patients. There are some locations, such as the abdominal wall, where surgery has excellent outcomes. But even in those locations, a person may end up with a surgical mesh that has its own set of complications. And I think the key thing here is that whatever medical treatment we do should not be worse than the disease itself. So in the appropriate cases, surgery is useful, but increasingly it's getting deprioritized for less aggressive and more gentler approaches. So in terms of other localized therapy, there is some burgeoning interest in like ablations, such as cryoablations, or even transarterial chemoembolization, typically using doxorubicin. But there's not a robust data, and that field is, you know, we're just starting to see some papers and in that space.
So not to make it much of an analogy to CLL, but it does kind of sound like you're choosing between observation and systemic therapy. How do you decide whether to consider treating a patient, particularly when you have the possibility it could be stable or reduced? Do you watch them? Do you I heard one speaker talk about waiting to see the documentation of growth three different times on imaging. I'm sure it's very individualized, but in general, how do you decide whether to consider treating the patient?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very individualized, and it's really a case to case decision, and it's very much a patient driven decision as well. Do you watch and wait, or do you wait and worry? So it's part of that. I think a lot of the decisions are based on symptoms that the patient's having, function, and how much this is impacting their quality of life. I think if it meets that criteria of significantly impacting their quality of life, and routine supportive care cannot adequately control it, then one must discuss about a form of treatment, whether that is a localized therapy or whether it's a systemic therapy. The conversation begins then. I do think there is a meaningful value to this active surveillance, but it should not come at the cost of the patient suffering and negatively impairing their quality of life.
So let's talk a little bit about what we knew about systemic therapy prior to ESMO this past fall when everything changed. But there have been, and I'm amazed too, that the randomized studies have been done in this disease, not to mention the recent ones, but even in the past, I think it was around 2018 where we saw a couple of trials with TKIs, pazopanib and sorafenib. So again, before these new data came out, how were these agents being used? What was the systemic therapy?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think those trials of randomized phase three studies were really a watershed moment that we were able to show that even in rare diseases such as this, that randomized studies are feasible. Prior to that, I would say from the 70s onwards, most of the drugs were methotrexate plus vinorelbine, methotrexate plus vinblastine, and increasingly liposomal doxorubicin. People have used, doxorubicin, but generally we think that's probably a little too aggressive for this disease, and a gentler form of anthracycline such as liposomal doxorubicin gets the job done. So that's where, and we still use it, these drugs are actively used. And for example, liposomal doxorubicin is an excellent tolerated drug and has nice activity. So, but methotrexate, vinblastine, weekly dosing, much more onerous on patients' time and quality of life. But liposomal doxorubicin is well used. But again, I have to say, none of those studies have robust sort of randomized, data. The first time we've truly done a randomized data was with sorafenib compared to placebo with a crossover. That was a watershed moment for the field because we were first and foremost able to show feasibility. Most experts thought that one could never do randomized studies in these rare diseases. But, having a international collaboration and a large cooperative group, we were certainly able to accrue patients actually in record speed. So we were able to show feasibility that these studies could be done and that the output was interpretable and meaningful.
To me, the data from the two TKI studies looked pretty good. I mean, the hazard rates were low. I mean, of course, yeah. Everybody knows about these drugs and the fact that they're not that easily tolerated. But were you using them prior to these new data?
Not. We were starting to use them. And I think some of those, you know, sorafenib, for example, was really, I mean, it all started with Gleevec. And, you know, there was phase two studies done, but the response rates and the benefit was really poor. So we knew we were heading the right direction, but I think sorafenib turned out to be a much better TKI. And it was really started off as a single patient use that just sort of expanded, got some early data, which then gave enough data to sort of move into the, and even that early phase two data resulted in NCCN indication. So that people started using it. So, but the phase three study really sort of made this, you know, as one of the top choices in the space.
Maybe we ought to start talking about the these new agents, particularly nirogacestat. Actually, I heard you pronounced it differently. How do you pronounce it again?
Nirogacestat, yeah.
Right. So maybe you can talk a little bit about these new agents, the gamma secretase inhibitors, what they are, what the thinking was in terms of whether they would be helpful with this disease process, and then we'll get into the trials. And incidentally, one of the things I was going to ask you about, you pulled off this phase three trial, which is incredible, but I was curious why you didn't have why the control arm was placebo and not a TKI.
Sure. I mean, let me start with this new class of drugs, and then we can get sort of into the nitty-gritty details of the DeFi study and the trial design itself. So first, you know, these gamma secretase inhibitors, they've been around for 3 decades. And initially, you know, there's a lot of activating notch mutations in ALL. But the first iteration of these drugs, I believe back almost 25 years ago, were just very toxic from a GI perspective. But even prior to oncology, these gamma secretase inhibitors, they were really first evaluated in the neurological Alzheimer's space. And there were massive, you know, hundreds of millions of dollar big studies that turned out to be negative. And then when it failed sort of in the CNS space, then it moved into oncology. And again, in oncology, there was a lot of data on notch signaling and Wnt signaling. But many of these studies in, say, pancreatic cancer and many other things almost 10, 15 years ago also turned out to be negative. But amongst that big, large pile of data, there was this tiny little signal of activity in desmoid tumors. In fact, the very first phase one study, there was 70% response rate in desmoid tumors. So that really got like people in this rare cancer field very excited and intrigued. And that's how we did the phase two and subsequently the phase three. The gamma secretase enzyme actually is very ubiquitous in a cell, and it plays a whole host of different functions. I mean, it plays a role in notch signaling. It plays probably another 20 to 30 different completely distinct functions in cell-cell adhesion. And, you know, for example, in multiple myeloma, it plays a key role in cleavage of BCMA. So it has a lot of different functions. And it's being evaluated, you know, in the unique setting. But in desmoid tumors, we think it's related to the Wnt and notch signaling pathway, but a lot of that work still needs to be very deeply flushed out.
I was just going to ask you, I was working with Sagar Lonial from Emory in myeloma recently. I saw he had this paper at ASCO looking at nirogacestat with belantamab. What's the thinking there? And is that still an active interest? Somehow it increases the BCMA availability, or how does it work? Does it work?
No, that I'm not a multiple myeloma person, so I can't answer you, does it work? But the concept is very clever and intriguing, because from my understanding is that resistance to BCMA based therapy comes from for BCMA to sort of get activated, you need a gamma secretase enzyme. right? Mm. So when you are trying to inhibit that pathway, one of the mechanisms of resistance, it appears, is sort of a overactivation of gamma secretase and sort of an independence from BCMA engagement with the drug. So by now giving it in conjunction with a gamma secretase inhibitor, you can either delay resistance or recapture efficacy. That's essentially the concept. I think it's a really clever and intriguing concept and application of a drug in really completely different and intriguing sort of mechanism.
Let me ask you a basic question. Is this a TKI? Because it ends with stat, which I associate more with, anyhow, it's not a TKI. Is it a small molecule or what is it?
Yes, it's a small molecule, but it does not hit any kinases to the best of our knowledge. It's truly a very highly selective gamma secretase enzyme. And this is not, you know, I think the gamma secretase field is really nascent. And I think with the, you know, with these, with nirogacestat, you know, we're going to learn a whole lot more about this pathway or pathways in general. But I think this is new to our whole field.
I know you're going to get into the data in the trial, but just sort of globally, because I know you've taken care of a lot of these patients, what do you see from a tolerability point of view? What kind of quality of life issues come up, side effects?
You mean with this drug, mm-hmm. nirogacestat? Yeah, it's actually right. It's a very well-tolerated drug, really well-tolerated. And patients overall have had a very favorable opinion. And anecdotally, you know, in my own practice, I have found patients find this drug a lot more tolerable than sorafenib, which, you know, in the chronic setting, even with dose reductions, it can be tough to tolerate, you know, with fatigue and, you know, all sorts of other things. Not to suggest that this drug has no side effects, but to say, you know, if you were to compare cross trials or just anecdotally in my own clinical use, this drug seems to be much better tolerable than a TKI such as sorafenib.
Interesting. All right, well, let's keep going in terms of how this story evolved and led to this incredible presentation.
Yeah, so, you know, it's a lot of the credit probably goes to the patient advocacy group. This is a organization known as DTRF, which is the Desmoid Tumor Research Foundation, really started by two women about 15 years ago who had family members or themselves diagnosed with desmoid tumors and were completely lost. They went all over the country trying to get expert advice, and no one really could give them a straight answer. So out of that sense of frustration, they started this patient advocacy group, which has now become sort of the patient advocacy group for desmoid tumors. So even when this early signal with gamma secretase inhibition was first seen, it was really a lot of pushing and advocacy by this patient advocacy group, urging clinicians, urging scientists, urging pharmaceutical industry to keep pushing this. If it were not for them, this class of drugs would have been just shelved by pharmaceutical company. We would not have seen the light of day. So I think a lot of the credit goes to patient advocacy and how they have leveraged their independence and their objectivism to push different stakeholders to come under one roof. And so I think a lot of success truly goes to them. So, I mean, the phase one, as I mentioned before, was pretty outstanding with 70% response rate, but the denominator was just 7 patients. So 5 out of 7 patients had a nice RECIST response that was durable for years on end. Then we had a phase 2 study that was actually done by NCI. So the NCI, you know, worked with pharma to do the study where the response rate was significantly lower, but intriguing enough to move it forward in phase 3. And what was beneficial is that we had already done the phase 3 study in sorafenib. So there was already sort of a model and a template in place that essentially said that, look, you can do a placebo-controlled study here. We demonstrated feasibility. We demonstrated, you know, that with global cooperation, we can certainly conduct these kind of studies in a rapid manner. So then the phase three study started almost 5 years ago, 4 years ago. And again, you know, very robust international accrual of patients to this study who were, you know, either randomized to drug versus placebo. And at the time of resist progression, they were crossed over to the drug arm.
I was going to say, maybe you could go through the data, what was seen there.
The DeFi study, which is the desmoid fibromatosis study with nirogacestat versus placebo, was an international study that was done in North America and Europe. You know, 37 sites, 142 patients who were randomized in a 1:1 manner to nirogacestat versus placebo. And the primary endpoint was progression-free survival. And the secondary endpoint was the, you know, response rate, and importantly, also patient-reported outcomes. And I'll get to that shortly, but to cut to the chase, the study met its primary endpoint, and the nirogacestat had the placebo arm had a median PFS of 15 months, while nirogacestat, it had not yet been reached, which gave us a hazard ratio of 0.29, which was highly statistically significant. So the drug was, you know, it met its primary endpoint. It was clearly active. But even when you look under, when these pre-specified subgroup analysis was done, whether you looked at it with gender, mutational status, you know, do they have beta-catenin, which is the most common mutation, or APC, which is associated with FAP, whether regardless of the location, whether it was single or multifocal, whether people had prior surgeries or chemotherapies or even prior tyrosine kinase inhibitors, it really didn't matter. The drug worked in every single one of these subgroups when we looked at it carefully. And the secondary endpoint was response rates. And as you mentioned before, you know, this is a disease where you can see spontaneous remissions. So the response rate for nirogacestat was, if I recall, close to 41%, and placebo was significantly lower than that. And the last point is that, you know, as I mentioned to you before, is that, you know, these tumors, you know, they don't cause death in all patients. In other words, the overall survival is not a good endpoint. And as you know, in oncology, we have always used response rates as well as PFS as a surrogate endpoints for overall survival. But if overall survival is not an important endpoint, then how do we know that, you know, what does it mean if the PFS improves over patients? So in order to answer the question, we fundamentally wanted to know, you know, do patients feel better? In other words, is there an improvement in their quality of life? Is there an improvement in their function? Is there an improvement in their pain? So we used many different patient-reported outcomes. In fact, there was a patient-reported outcomes that was specifically developed just for this disease in a way that is in line with FDA guidance on development of patient-reported outcomes. So across many different metrics and many different instruments, nirogacestat was significantly better in terms of improving pain, in terms of improving symptoms, and in terms of improving function. So the drug not only improved, you know, the PFS and response rates, but most importantly, patients felt better. And we felt that was truly a very, very important outcome of this study.
I think a lot of people... To me, the thing that when I watched that presentation, the thing that jumped right off was the patient-reported outcome. Because a lot of times people, they report that, and I can't really grasp what it means, but it was easy to see on that, and I thought it was really great, and the whole strategy. Let me ask you another issue. One of the things that I know was an issue in the earlier studies was the criteria to enter, particularly given the possibility of spontaneous remission. How did you build in the criteria so you wouldn't get, you would try to reduce the number of spontaneous regressions? How much, what did they have to do to get in this trial?
Yeah, good question. And that's really always a challenge. As I mentioned to you before, these spontaneous remissions in this disease make trial design very challenging. Or you have to power it adequately, but sometimes these sample size gets very big if you pick the wrong endpoint, such as response rates. So one way we wanted to limit the number of patients who may spontaneously regress are by selecting patients who are progressing. So people needed to have a 20% RECIST progression within the last 12 months in order to enter the study. Again, that's no guarantee that you know, patients will not have a spontaneous regression. I think the prospective study from the Italian group showed that even patients who are progressing, they can still enter into a regression phase. So we don't have the perfect criteria, but this was good enough at the time that we were designing the study.
Well, it seemed like it worked because you had less responses in the placebo group than the earlier studies. I think it was like 6% or something. And in the earlier studies, I think it was more like 20 or more. So
that's correct.
I guess what you did worked, although trying to apply it's going to be another issue. What about the trial data on tolerability? What fraction of patients had to stop because of side effects? And particularly, what's the issue with the ovarian dysfunction, which is a complete mystery to me, but maybe you can explain it.
Yeah, no, they're all great questions. So as I mentioned before, you know, the drug is a very well-tolerated drug. Most patients tolerate this really well. And with some dose adjustments, you can really get patients to be on this drug on a chronic regimen for a meaningful period of time. In terms of, the major side effects with this drug are gastrointestinal. So this could be diarrhea, some nausea, vomiting, and also skin rash. So those are, I would say, probably the two of the major areas of side effects are basically gastrointestinal as well as rash. And then a completely unexpected side effect was ovarian dysfunction. So, when we first started seeing ovarian dysfunction, we needed to basically pause the study, amend the protocol and the informed consent form before moving forward. The ovarian dysfunction really sort of can be of many different types. One, it could be, just basically amenorrhea or, sort of significant decrease in the female reproductive hormone levels where it may impact fertility. But what we saw in this study is that about, 75% of women who are of childbearing potential reported some form of ovarian dysfunction. So that's 27 women out of 36 women of childbearing potential had changes in their hormone levels when we looked at it carefully, or other fertility issues. So almost 11 of those 27 patients, 41%, they discontinued the drug. And the good news is that all of them had their ovarian dysfunction resolved when they stopped the drug. So that was truly very reassuring. In the remaining patients who said, no, we want to keep going on this drug, some of them, their ovarian dysfunction resolved while they were on the drug. So about 64% of them, or 9 out of 14 patients who chose to remain on the drug even though they had these things, just with time, as time evolved, their symptoms got better. And then another 5 or 36% is unresolved, but it's important to note that they still continue on the drug. Then there was a few patients who were lost to follow. But I think what I would say is that the number of patients we've treated is really small. And I think this phenomenon just needs to be studied more carefully. And to your question about, what is the biological process behind that? I don't think anyone knows it fully, but it appears that these gamma secretase enzymes, as well as the Notch signaling pathway, they're both important in ovarian maturation and other processes. I'm not an expert in that space, but it seems like it's a direct on-target effect of the drug in a different organ. system.
So we're actually doing a webinar next week with Ann Partridge from Dana-Farber, who's done a lot of work in premenopausal breast cancer. We're going to be talking about fertility preservation, prevention of premature menopause, et cetera. Of course, in breast cancer, it's a very different story. Here, you're just getting started trying to figure out what's going on. It'll be interesting to see how it evolves. You know, maybe there'll be situations where you maybe will in the future offer fertility preservation strategies. What about for women who, theoretically, for women who don't wish to have future children in terms of hormone replacement therapy? Do you think potentially that could have a damaging effect in any way or not necessarily?
You know, I think we try to, although the link seems to be weak, in general, we try to stay away from any sort of hormonal replacement therapy in this disease. There still is some concern that some of these hormonal replacement therapies, whether it's estrogen or progesterone-based or even testosterone-based, that can actually make the tumors grow. But in terms of fertility preservation, you know, whether you're doing methotrexate, vinorelbine, or liposomal doxorubicin, or sorafenib, or this drug, in general, you know, most of the patients are young people. I mean, most of these people are in their 20s and 30s. You know, they are in college, they have graduated, they are newly married, and they wish to have their own start their own families. So out of the right thing to do, at least in my practice, and I think in most practice, is to sort of counsel them appropriately. We refer all patients to a fertility specialist to have this conversation. If necessary, you know, men will undergo sperm banking and women will choose to do, you know, egg retrieval for future IVF. But as you know, many of those things are not covered by insurance. So it creates a bit of a conundrum, especially if there is inequities in healthcare and access to those sort of services, which are frequently not covered by insurance.
You were mentioning some of the hormonal therapies that have been considered here. Has ovarian suppression or ablation been studied in this disease? And do you see like spontaneous regression more during menopause?
We can see spontaneous. This has not been studied as rigorously as we should, but the short answer is yes. I mean, I think you're very insightful in asking that question about menopause. Yes, during menopause or as women enter into menopause, we do see some spontaneous regressions. We also see spontaneous regressions after pregnancy. So sometimes these tumors grow, in the state of pregnancy, and in the postpartum state, these tumors can start regressing as well. So there may be a link, but is that link hormonal? Is that link related to, you know, vascular biology changes that happen with pregnancy? It's not entirely clear.
So any patients, I know we have some slides from some of your patients, but just any, you know, scenarios that you recall where patients, I guess you didn't know what they were getting on the trial, but I'm guessing you figured it out after a while to see if they had tumor shrinkage. Any situations where you saw a patient really benefit because of a response that you can recall?
Yeah, I mean, I treated a good number of patients, and I would say almost all of them had, those who are on the drug had a nice benefit, measured in different ways. Sometimes it's radiographic regression, and in others, it's improvement in quality of life. I mean, I had this young woman who's a school teacher with two young kids who had a very large mass in her groin, you know, unable to bend down to pick up her kids, you know, unable to stand in the classroom for a long time. So it was really considering sort of, you know, how this disease was going to, you know, interfere with her work life as well as her home life. So, but when she came onto this, and she was intolerant as well as failed prior lines of therapy such as doxorubicin as well as sorafenib. So when she came on this study, she almost had a pretty dramatic shrinkage in her tumor. I think within the first scan, she had like a 30-40% RECIST shrinkage. But more importantly, you know, she was able to really engage as a mother at home, you know, with her two young kids, and also at work, you know, as a teacher, she was able to, you know, sort of be fully present at school. So there was an, you know, that's one anecdotal example, but there are many, many such examples like that.
Any tolerabilities that this woman experienced? And in general, could you tell who was on the drug and who wasn't on the drug?
It's a little hard to tell who was on the drug, who was not on the drug. And as you can imagine, a drug like sorafenib, you can pretty quickly tell, you know, the hair color changes, you know, their blood pressure goes up, you know, you have a pretty decent sense of what's going on. But with this drug, it's a little bit more challenging. It was hard to guess whether they were on placebo or on the drug.
What's the typical time course that you've observed yourself in the patients who responded? When do they usually start responding, and how long do they continue to respond over a long period of time?
No, that's a good question. You know, this disease, desmoid tumor, is not something that, this is a disease that takes time to grow. This is not, you know, this is not an pancreatic adenocarcinoma or a lymphoma that just rapidly grows right in front of your eyes. So these tumors take time to grow and they take time to regress. So even if you have a great drug, you know, regression or control of the disease takes time. Generally, we start seeing, you know, some signs of activity as early as 3 months with the first scan. But typically somewhere in the 6 to 8 month range is when we truly start seeing a good, robust improvement in scans. But what's important to know is that generally in my own experience, I found that when you look at patient-reported outcomes and if you talk to patients and their quality of life, that improves much, much sooner than the radiographic improvements. So that's also another reassuring thing that, you know, you're on the right track with these drugs.
I've also heard that there's some patients where you don't actually see the tumor looking changing or shrinking, but their symptoms get better. Have you observed that?
Yeah, no, we've certainly seen that. It's more complicated when you say that tumors don't change. Tumors do change, but they are not properly evaluated if you just look at the dimensions, if you use a RECIST criteria. So as you know, RECIST only looks at tumor dimension at the longest dimension. But these tumors are not the perfect spherical tumors. They are, you can imagine a football. You know, if it deflates, you know, the tip to tip, you have to conclude by RECIST that there's been no change in the tumor at all. But if you look at the sides of a football that's deflated, you know that this thing is significantly smaller. So we are stuck with RECIST and for the time being. But what we notice is that tumors that even if they don't change in their dimensions, there is a shift in their cellularity. So tumors that are highly cellular, they start transforming into collagen. And this transformation from a cellular tumor to a collagen certainly correlates with eradicating the disease, controlling the disease, but also improvement in patient-reported outcomes as well. Some of the data has not been fully analyzed, so some of that work is still ongoing. So tumor response or regression is much more nuanced than just sort of a dimensional change that we see with many other malignancies.
I think the other thing was, I believe this study had a crossover, and I don't think they presented the data. Do you know what happened? Have you seen patients cross over? I would guess they probably respond.
Yeah, so patients who are on placebo, who had a 20% tumor growth, were allowed to cross over into the treatment arm. But if a patient didn't meet that radiographic criteria of 20% growth, but they just had clinical progression, in other words, their symptoms got worse, they were not permitted to cross over. And some of this was designed to, you know, basically, you know, cross over too quickly. So the criteria was truly just radiographic progression in order to cross over. And when patients do cross over, they get benefit from the drug. And I've seen that as well. That data has not been presented, but in my own experience, those patients who crossed over are now responding.
Have you seen any patients progress after responding or even maybe in progressing primarily? And what's thought to be mechanisms of resistance?
I think the mechanism of resistance, if any, may be a subtherapeutic dosing of the drug or drug holidays. But I have not yet seen, and I don't imagine these tumors are going to evolve similar to, say, your carcinomas in clever ways to overcome drug. I think, for lack of a better word, you know, at the genomic level, they're sort of quite simplistic. And if a drug works, it just works. And if it doesn't work, it may be related to pharmacology issues.
Really amazing. You wonder, too, if there's any lessons, if there's any relevance to carcinomas, to other cancers. You know, it's such a unique approach. Is this being studied in other tumors? And any reason to be optimistic it might be helpful? Or do you think it's just specific to this kind of scenario?
No, I think that's a great question. You know, the beauty of rare diseases is that, whether it's rare disease or rare cancer, is that invariably these tumors or other diseases are characterized by a single sort of a genetic alteration. So in desmoid tumors, as I mentioned before, this is ubiquitously a beta-catenin mutated tumor, or in rare cases, an APC-driven. But this is a great model. It's a great disease to study and isolate the Wnt signaling pathway. And in any other malignancies, we all know that Wnt and Notch play a very critical role in cancer growth and metastasis. But among the, you know, dozens and dozens of different cellular networks, it's very hard to isolate this single pathway itself. So I think, you know, about 10 years ago or 15 years ago, as I mentioned before, there was a huge interest in these gamma secretase enzymes in oncology. They were studied with other chemotherapies, and many of them failed. It really didn't go anywhere at all. But I think we were probably not carefully selecting patients or combining these drugs with the right drugs. I think there may be value, personally, I think, in maybe combining this with checkpoint blockades. Because one theory is that these, you know, tumors that have sort of Wnt signaling alterations are also sort of immunologically quiet. Their microenvironment is quiet or quote cold. So maybe this is a mechanism of sort of making these cold tumors hot. But that's also a very loaded space, and I think we've been struggling with that space in oncology for quite some time. You know, trying to convert cold tumors to hot tumors with very little success.
So let's just finish out with the other study presented at ESMO, another gamma secretase inhibitor, doesn't have a name at this point that I know of, AL102, interesting phase 2-3 trial that you all presented. Can you talk a little bit about that agent, how it compares to nirogacestat, and what these new data show?
This is another gamma secretase inhibitor, and I think it's really indistinguishable from nirogacestat. And again, it's early data, but one thing that we are noticing is that how you dose these drugs may matter. So in the phase 2 study, we looked at daily dosing. We looked at, you know, 2 days of dosing with 5 days off in a week and other forms. But one thing what we've seen in the AL102 or the Ringside study is that those responses are pretty rapid. So within the first scan, we're seeing some pretty dramatic tumor shrinkage, and also this change from a cellular tumor to a collagen. But fundamentally, these are all they all belong to the same class of drugs, which is the gamma secretase enzymes. So I would expect that from a side effect profile, from an efficacy profile, these drugs should be in the ballpark similar to each other.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to Dr. Gounder, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Oncology Today.